I like to start with a meditation. So find a position that you can stay in for 10-15 minutes. And focus on the tip of your nose, on that place where air is coming in and out. And watch the sensation of the movement of the air in and out. In one particular spot between your nostrils. And now imagine yourself having reached the ultimate goal, where you have reached enlightenment itself. Where you have now an exquisite, perfect mind. A mind that is omniscient. A mind that can see all things in all directions, in all times. A mind that has perfect compassion for all beings. A mind that has a perfect love for all beings equally. And everything that you touch with your mind is an emanation of you. That you are spontaneously sending out in all directions. Watching the play of the entire universe, which is you, a perfect illusion that is made of your love. You are so perfect that every single object that you perceive is producing immaculate bliss in you. You are able to emanate bodies on all planets to help all beings spontaneously and simultaneously. In every interaction with any object is total bliss for you. And at the same time, it's all an illusion. It's just a play. And you know it. Nothing is real. Nothing is out there. Not even you. It's all your lama. And we say that everything in our world has to come from causes. So think for a moment, what would be the causes for this kind of existence? What would you need to do to create the causes for this kind of enlightened existence? Do you know what you need to do? Do you know what those causes would be? Do you know what you need to do to get there? So think about all the pain that still exists in your world. It's all coming from your heart. So whatever pain exists in the world, and whatever happiness exists in the world, they're all coming from your heart. And once your heart is pure, it can no longer produce this pain in the world. So connect to this thought of this desire to purify yourself, your being, so that the world that you will be projecting from your heart will be totally pure and blissful. And try to create this burning desire to do it for the sake of every being, because every being that is suffering, it's because you have not reached that state yet. Just like you are projecting the world from your heart right now, also when you become enlightened, you will be projecting the world from your heart. The entire universe. The only difference is that you may not be aware of that fact now, and that the mind is not totally pure. So ask yourselves, what are the seeds that you need to plant for this in your awareness? What are the seeds you need to plant now so that they ripen into total purity? So remember those questions, okay? Keep them in the background. And with these questions in mind, we're going to listen to the wisdom of a great, great sage called Master Saraha. He was the teacher of Aryanagarjuna. He was the Lama of Aryanagarjuna. So he probably lived the 2nd century, something like that, in India. And he was a wild yogi. He lived in the mountains. There was nothing ordinary about him. He was extraordinary, both in his outward behavior and also in his mind. And his teachings are very extraordinary. So we will start with the verses that you have on the first page. And this is a translation that Lama Christy made. And this verse talks about emptiness and compassion. I'm just going to read it first and then we'll talk about it a little. So everybody has access to a text. It says, "You might be good at emptiness, but if you lack compassion, then you're still a person who has yet to find the highest path. That's the first verse. Okay? Second, you may be focused on compassion, but if that's all you do, then you're stuck inside the cycle and you'll never reach the goal. But if you're someone capable of joining them together, you won't get lost inside either samsara or nirvana. So the title on the need for two, and the two are what? Are emptiness and compassion. So Master Saraha talks about two very important aspects of the path, which sometimes we call by different names, right? Those of you who have done any ACI courses, or course number one in particular, we talk about tapan shera, wisdom and method. Wisdom and method. And what he's saying, we need both. He speaks about emptiness. Emptiness is the side of wisdom, and compassion is the side of method. And he says you need both. You can't do just one of them. Neither one of them will help you, really. And this is a very famous verse. Maybe you have seen it, or you have seen it. And we had this in our meditation, really. If you remember, there were echoes of both in our meditation. So the first part talks about emptiness, the first verse. And maybe for those of you who are taught it in you, I'll say just, I mean, this we studied this for years and years and years, so I'll say two sentences. It will not be a replacement for the study of emptiness. The idea of emptiness talks about the ultimate reality that surrounds us, the ultimate reality of every object in our life, including ourselves. And it's asking, who am I and who am I not? So it's coming from these questions when you explore, wisdom explores reality, right? Who am I and who am I not? And so everybody has heard, has seen Geshe-la waving the pen. He says you need to see it 7,000 times before it sinks in. So it's a very beautiful and very simple way to present to a new audience the idea of emptiness. It's very simple, really, very simple. It's like when you're asking, what is this? If I ask you, what is this, what would you say? You'll say, it's a pen, right? And you bring a dog into the room and you wave this, it would probably not start writing with this, right? It would maybe start chewing on it. So to a human, this presents itself in one way. A human sees a pen. A dog will see something else, a chewing toy. And the next step is, then what is it, really? You just assume that the universe is composed only of humans and dogs, okay, for a moment. So what is it, really?
An object.
See, we run into difficulty. We can't say, because two beings perceive something totally different. And that's the whole idea behind emptiness. The whole idea is that without the observer, you can't really say what it is. You can't say there's an objective thing which it is, and just this being sees it correctly and this being doesn't see it correctly. We can't say that. No way to say that. That's the emptiness of the pen. The emptiness of the pen is that it's empty of being a pen from its own side. There is no pen that from its own side is an objective pen. That is not there. And whatever applies to this pen applies to everything, including myself. Including any idea I have of myself is, like you say, projection. And that goes beyond emptiness. So what is it not? It's not a pen from its own side. Then what is it? Emptiness talks about what it's not. It's a negative concept. It's what it's not. It's empty of being a pen from its own side. Then what is it? And then you started giving an answer, right? What is it? It's a projection from the viewer's mind. So the dog will project a toy, and the human will project a pen, and other beings will project other things. So things do exist, and they appear in our lives in certain ways. That's their dependent origination. And that thing depends on our projections. So this is the emptiness that he's discussing here. So what he's saying, and what all the sages are saying, all the Buddhist sages for sure, is that to become free, to reach enlightenment, to reach this amazing state that we have described in the meditation a little bit, we didn't really describe, we just mentioned it, you have to study emptiness, and you have to figure out emptiness on a very deep level, way beyond the level we're doing now, okay? On a very deep level. So, and actually, we often say, especially in this school here, that our goal is to see emptiness, what we call to see emptiness directly, to experience emptiness in deep meditation, not just as an intellectual game. Right? And that's our goal. So suppose somebody reaches that experience. Suppose somebody reaches this amazing experience of having what we call seen emptiness directly or perceived emptiness directly in deep meditation, reach that state, immersed in that state. Master Saraha and then commentaries on him say, you can't stay there. This is not your ultimate goal. It is not your ultimate goal to stay immersed in emptiness. If you recall the meditation, what was the ultimate goal? The ultimate goal is to create a world where there is no suffering, right? It's to save all beings from suffering, to create a world where you are not suffering and all beings are not suffering. A blissful world, a world of happiness that you can stay in 24/7 and so with everybody else. So the experience of seeing emptiness directly is only a milestone. It's not the goal, it's only a step towards the goal. You can't without it, okay? You have to reach that stage. So our teachers here say, okay, we'll teach you and train you to get you to this point, because then you'll continue, then you'll guarantee to continue. And that's the beauty about the experience of seeing emptiness directly, that once a person reaches that stage, they will automatically continue. So you hear a lot, especially from Geshe-la and Lama Christi, to have to see emptiness directly. But these teachers here say, well, don't be confused. This is not your ultimate goal. This is just a step. It's not your final goal. So it is a very important step, but you can't leave it at that. You have to continue. You have to continue with your understanding of emptiness, to create a perfect world of appearance. Because this world, just like this pen, is appearing in front of me, right? It's projected by me. So my ultimate goal is to project a perfect world where all beings are perfect and not suffering, and I'm not suffering. And not just not suffering, in total ecstasy, 24/7. So immersing ourselves in emptiness is not sufficient. It won't reach us there. To create this perfect appearance, this perfect world, this perfect illusion, we have to create the causes for that perfection. And that was the meditation. Well, do you know what those causes are? What do you need to do to create this kind of world for yourself? So that's the first part. We can't just go for emptiness. But then comes the next part. But you can't also just go for compassion. So maybe you, or you may meet other people who have a beautiful, compassionate heart that are totally devoted to helping other beings, that can go and serve the sick or serve the poor, do those things with a total giving, open heart, just lose themselves in the action of helping others, etc. And some may go to very high levels of compassion, like really giving away their lives to serve others, to make others happy. And then do they actually make them happy? Do they actually make them happy? So you may help a sick person, and suppose you succeed, okay? Suppose you succeed and you help them recover. What's happening next? What will happen next? Within a short time they'll be back, they'll have again some kind of sickness, some kind of illness, old age will catch up with them, or some accident will catch up with them. Even the highest levels of compassion in this sense aren't able to really make people happy. And that's the truth that we need to acknowledge. You nurse somebody that is sick and you help them recover and you send them out, you release them from the hospital and send them into what? You just release them so that they come back. You know, they will come back. With this same sickness or another sickness, but they will come back. So it's like putting a small band-aid on a huge big sore, a huge big wound. They have fatal disease. It's fatal. They have Lord of Death inside. So you're putting a little band-aid on that. So can we really say that we help someone with our ordinary kind of help? Which is beautiful. We're not saying it's not beautiful. Actually, we're saying you have to have that on your path. But you can't have just that. Because just that won't really make people happy, won't really make you happy. So, what these verses are suggesting, as well as other teachings, is that unless your action in the world, unless your compassionate action in the world, is imbued with the wisdom of emptiness, it will not really help others. Then you're very, very, very limited in what you can do in the world. Almost pointless. It's like somebody's dying, which we're all dying, right? We're all dying. And you're fixing a little wound, but they're dying. And even we can take it further, not just compassionate action, but any spiritual activity. So, for example, we would say it's a spiritual goal for me to learn how to be a calm person. Or it's a spiritual goal for me to learn how to not get angry at situations where I normally get upset. Or it's a spiritual goal to learn how to be totally generous and give as much as I can. Or it's a spiritual goal to learn how to be a very moral person, to keep my ethics nicely. Or you can list a spiritual goal of developing deep meditation, being able to meditate well. All of these things, unless they're imbued with the wisdom of emptiness, you can't even call them method. Because why is it called method? It's a method to bring you to enlightenment, to bring you to ultimate happiness. But these things, without the wisdom of emptiness, don't get you anywhere. You can be the best meditator, it won't get you anywhere. You can be the most moral person. Without that wisdom, it won't save you. Which is not to say that these are not worthy spiritual goals. We're not saying that. Don't hear that, okay? They are very important spiritual milestones that we all need to work on and develop. But they have to be imbued with the wisdom of emptiness. Because we meet lots of people who keep their morality. We meet very beautiful, pure monks or nuns who are very moral, I mean, and have been keeping it for many years, and they're very pure and very deep meditators. Lots of people who have learned to control their anger. We meet those people. Still the world is suffering. They live in a suffering world, and they themselves are getting old and dying. So, all those things that we mentioned, like learning how to reduce anger, etc., they are still worldly goals. And they will wear out. even if you have achieved those goals, it will wear out unless you have gained the wisdom of emptiness. When I say the wisdom of emptiness, a synonym to that is the understanding where all pain is coming. Because in our current state, even the most moral and the people, the deep meditators, etc., we are projecting a world which has some beauty in it and some happiness in it, but also a lot of suffering in it. And our ultimate goal is to project a world where there's only bliss, only happiness, totally pure. So the last verse that we read says, but if you are someone capable of joining them together, joining what? Compassion and the wisdom of emptiness. And compassion here stands for method, what we do, how we practice. He says, if you are capable of joining the two together, you won't get lost inside either samsara or nirvana. So then comes a commentator on Master Sarhar, whose name is Master Avaduti, and he's suggesting ways to this state of not being lost in either samsara or nirvana. And he says to reach that state you need to be able to do two things. Only two things, right? We have Gilukta list. Two things. You do two things, you're out of it. Here's what he says. One, you have to learn to stop grasping to things as things. To things as themselves. To the pen as the pen from its own self. Stop grasping to things as being able to function from their own side. Because when we say things, in Buddhism, a thing is something that functions. A thing is something that performs a function. That's a thing. Nupa in Tibetan. Nupa. So we think that the pen is writing because it's a pen. So somehow the penness or the ability to write is in the pen. Or the recorder, whatever mechanism it has inside and has the buttons, and if I press the right button it will record. We believe in functioning things. The world that we live in is composed of functioning things. That's how we live. I need to write, I'll take a pen, it will write. I need to brush my teeth, I take a toothbrush, I'll do this. So we believe in functioning things. He says, if I ever want to reach that state of total bliss, I have to let go of this belief. Because it's wrong. It's a wrong view. It's a wrong view to grasp to things as having any type of ability to function from their own side. Why is it wrong that things do not function from their own side? Why is it wrong? We go back to the pen. If the pen was a pen from its own side, then what?
To write any time.
It will,
for everyone.
It will always write. It will always write, right? Except sometimes they stop writing. So it's not a writing thing from its own side, or a writing thing would always write, right? That's the definition of a writing thing. It will always write. And also, it would be perceived by any creature as a writing instrument. But it's not. Okay. For it to be a writing instrument, I need to be able to project it as a writing instrument. For somebody to think up a pen, that already says a lot about you. Still, we need you to get the idea of a pen. So it's not enough that somebody invented a pen and you connect to their preconceived idea and now you can write. That's not enough, because you have to connect to that idea. So you have to have certain seeds in your mind to be able to connect, and the dog will never connect to that preconceived idea of a pen. Will never. They don't have those seeds active now in their mind. So it's not only that somebody has thought up that idea. That's how you can learn how to write. A child can learn how to write because, you know, somebody shows them. But you can do the same educational process with a dog forever and they won't start writing.
Yeah.
So it's mostly about you. So it's mostly about what you have to have in your mind to project a pen, or, in our case, a world of bliss, you know?
Yeah.
And it's up to you. So this was the meditation about. It was, what do I need to have in my mind to act as a cause for this desired result? And that's a deep, deep question. And that goes back to, what do I need to have in my mind to perceive this as a pen when I need to write? And it's kind of similar, except this is a mundane goal, you know, a temporary goal, and here we're talking about saving all beings from all pain. So in its scope, it's very different. But in the wisdom that lies behind it, it's the same. It's the same. The same wisdom that will enable me to understand where pains are coming from, that same wisdom will get me to create a perfect world. Same wisdom. That's the emptiness. That's the wisdom of emptiness. The wisdom that says that things are not one way or the other from their side. It's from me that I create a pen, it's from me that I create a suffering world, and from me that I will hopefully one day create a perfect world.
It's a question. You said when we identify things, we always attach a label that they're functioning things. I'm curious, is there anything that's not functioning? Things
is
that don't function?
Is there anything that's not a functioning thing? That's a separate discussion. I don't know.
It's a good question.
It's a good question. Yes.
Because everything is functioning. So why make that distinction that things are functioning? Everything is functioning.
Is that true?
Well, that's why I'm asking you. I'm asking you.
Is that true that everything is functioning? So if you think a little harder, you'll find a few examples of things that don't perform a function. One aspect of a functioning thing is that if it functions, then it does something, right? It does something. It produces something. There is change associated with it, right? Also means that it has to come from causes, because it causes other things. It is part of a causal process. So all those ideas are related to when we say thing in this connotation, in the Buddhist meaning. When we say thing, it's a functioning thing, means it's causing things. It itself has been caused, it is producing results, it itself is a result that was produced. All those are synonyms when I say thing. Now you're asking, are there things that are not like that? So let's just give one example.
So
anyone can think of something that is not a functioning thing.
Space
is the very natural example, right? Space was not caused. What caused space? Your projection.
Yeah.
Sure. So we can argue with it. But one thing we can say is emptiness is one such thing. It's not a functioning thing. It's not a thing, because it's an absence. Yes. And the whole discussion of things as functioning is to make clear that ultimate reality is not like conventional reality. So that's one thing that Master Vaduti, who is the commentator on Master Saraha, says, that we have to stop our belief in functioning things, that they function from their own side, that they are the way they are from their own side. So do pens write?
Yes.
They do. But what does he say? Not from their own side. They're not functioning as pens. Do recorders record?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do, except sometimes they don't. Just like pens. Because it's not coming from them. Because it's not coming from them. It's coming from me. And I point here, but really I should point here, which is what we did in the meditation. It's the seeds in me that are allowing me to perceive this as a functioning thing and this as a functioning thing, or things that I can utilize in my life. But the only way I can meet those things and be able to get them to function the way I expect them to is if I have planted the right seeds before. Otherwise, they're not going to function. They're not going to perform that function. Just like the dog doesn't have those seeds, so they don't function that way for them. They don't have those seeds active. They may have them dormant. So in our meditation, we were asking, what is it that I need? What seeds do I need to plant in my heart or in my mind, and the mind is in my heart, so that I can see a perfect world? And that's where the discussion is leading. Yeah, there was one more hand.
I don't know if this is really all that relevant, but the fact that that pen is not going to write without us using it, it's not going to function as a pen until somebody picks it up and writes with it. Does that have anything to do with it? And it won't function the moment as a chew toy until the dog picks it up and uses it as a chew toy?
That's true. That's true. But you're kind of saying the same thing, no? So you pick it up to write. You didn't pick this to write with, okay?
Right.
So your projection is there already. So it's either right now writing, or you perceive it as an instrument that you can write with when you choose to write with it. But that's the same thing. Then the second thing that Master Vedati says, not only do you have to let go of the wrong idea of functioning things, you also have to let go of what we call correct view. So he goes further. He goes further than we usually hear. What does it mean to let go of correct view? So what is correct view? We said what's wrong view. Wrong view is to think that this is a pen from its own side, and it writes from its own side, that it has penness or writingness in it, right? That's wrong view. So kind of everybody agrees with that now, right? So what is correct view? Correct view we also mentioned. This is a pen based on causes and conditions, or based on projections, or based on mental seeds, and you can talk about causes and conditions in different terms, but in only that way it will write, as a projection, for example. If I have the seeds to project a writing instrument, if I have helped beings function in the past, then I have this goodness in me, and then I can use this as a pen. So that's correct view. So why should I stop correct view? So stopping correct view does not mean go back to wrong view. Okay? That's not helpful at all. So if I'm saying that the pen has no nature of its own to be a pen, then I'm having a thought in my mind, right? I'm having a thought in my mind. This is not a pen from its own side. That thought, it's also something that I'm holding on to in my mind. Now I'm, okay, I got rid of wrong view, and now I have a correct view. I know that to have pens, I have to give away pens or have other pens. If I hold this as a self-existent truth, I'm back in the same problem. I haven't solved it much. Maybe I'll be more generous now. But I'm still holding. That's what he's saying. If you want to ever get out of this samsara and nirvana thing, you have to let go of any holding. That's what he's saying. So you can't hold on to your own views. You can't even hold on to your wisdom as wisdom. Because then if you hold to wisdom, then it becomes like this recorder or like this pen, something that will keep you in suffering. So this is some teaching on these verses. Next page, it's also by Master Sarha. The title is Lamakrishna, Steer Clear of Danger. He says, oh dearest ones, I urge you, reject all those who speak untrue, reject all those with backward ways, and further, cast out all those who believe in anything. Which ties back to what we just said. So anyone, he says, anyone who believes in anything, just stay away from them. Which is a problem, right? Because then you have to stay away from you. But that's the idea also. If you learn how to stay away from you, you're good. And the word he uses in the last line, Shempa. Shempa is the word he uses for something you believe in. So we believe in objects. We believe in things. We are brainwashed from the very moment we were born, and even from before that. We came into this world with this misperception, with this precondition for misperception, to believe in things. So why do we hold things? Why do we believe in things? Why do we hold on to them? Why are we getting attached to things? Why is it that we want things or want to get rid of things? So we are holding to things because we're attached to them, because we want them. What does it mean to reach that place where you don't believe in anything? What is it? We fear that situation. That situation which they say is freedom. But we fear that place, which is why we're not there. We fear that place. It's very uncomfortable. Because I want to be able to press a button and to record and to get this and the right. And it gives me a lot of comfort, gives me a sense of control over my life, which is just an illusion, right? But it gives me some, it gives me comfort. It gives me something to stand on. What if I let go of that belief that things work the way I think they work, that they function the way I think they function? So that's a really deep fear that we have in our heart. We fear that if we let go of that thought, we would become ungrounded and have nothing to stand on. So this is the flavor of Shempa. When you say Shempa, you can use other words for objects, but this word is an object that we believe in. That's the flavor. It comes with this holding, this attachment, along with a fear of letting go of that attachment. So there's a lot of emotion there. There's a lot of feeling that comes with our beliefs in objects. And in other contexts we also talk about our belief in ourselves. And those of you who have heard the term gakcha, there's also this, the same kind of sense of, there's an emotional content to the gakcha, to believing in a me that's really not there. And there's no problem with using me as a pronoun. Problem is the attachment I have to that, the content, the feeling that I'm investing into it, which is not related to me. And that's my problem. So Master Saraha in his verse is kind of rejecting believing in things. So when we talk about rejection of believing in things, we can talk on two levels. One is rejecting belief systems, all kinds of belief systems. And he has beautiful verses where he like rejecting everything, including Buddhism. Nothing is sacred. Everything is to be examined and to be let go of. Very, very profound and beautiful. No wonder he gave rise to Aryanagarjuna, right, as a student. So this is one thing that he does. Belief systems that we just cling to simply because they're comfortable. But also, he is rejecting maybe our own personal beliefs, not just belief systems like religions and methods, but also our own personal beliefs. That each one of us specifically holds, whether we are aware of them or not, which are all superstitions. So our minds are filled with those superstitions. I must get so many hours of sleep every night or else I can't function. Or I must have caffeine in the morning or else I cannot function. Or the opposite of that. God forbid, if I have too much caffeine, then I can't sleep or then I can't function. Everybody has their own belief system, and we have many, not just one. We have many, many assumptions about who we are that are superstitions. Because that's not who we are. And we get attached to them, and we cling to them. And they kind of create an identity for us. I am, and then you describe yourself in the single section, you know, I am so and so, and then you start believing that that's who you are. It kind of gives us a comfort. Hi, I'm Dora, I came from here, this is what I do. All things are just not ultimately true. I'm not the things that I believe about myself. Not true. And in fact, by believing all those things, we are limiting ourselves. We are limiting ourselves to a set of superstitions that we are clinging to. And we're thinking, that's who I am. And we are limiting the world to our beliefs on how things function, which is not the ultimate reality of this world. And it's very important in our personal practice that we work as hard as we can to break down those superstitions, to let go, because what these teachings say, anything that we are holding to will limit us, will not allow us to create this total bliss in the world, in our world and for others. And it's a constant struggle against our ego that wants to feel comfortable, that wants to have an identity, that wants to define things and compartmentalize things and all of that. So it's a constant struggle. Deliberately, in an informed way, break down those things that we are attached to, that are limiting us, that are killing us. So it's about breaking down those superstitions. It's such a hard practice to break down, because everything I know about myself is a superstition. Every single thing. Every single thing I know about myself is not ultimately true. Anything you would say about yourself is not ultimate truth. It's true nominally. But it's not your ultimate identity. Your ultimate identity is emptiness. So you have to have a very powerful method to help you break down those identities. And that's part of what's going on in Tantra in general. It gives you a chance to expand, to be a new kind of person, to be a much bigger being than you think you are. Much bigger. We live in a little box, and we believe certain things about ourselves and about the world, and that's how we live, and we don't see the world. We're not using even a tiny percentage of who we can be. It's giving ourselves a chance to expand to this totally different dimension. And the moment you hear those things, you can make a conscious effort of daily questioning and daily looking in your practice into this question of who you are, who you think you are. Eventually you'll need to get there. You'll have to break down those belief systems to a very deep level. For that you need a very powerful tool. But you can start the process even now. Figure out, each one of us, figure out the limitations that we are putting on ourselves, on our belief systems, that are really, really based in fear. We're afraid to step out of those boxes. We're used to them. They're kind of comfortable. We heard this presenter, she had this joke about Mr. Goldsmith. He goes to the tailor to order a suit. And the tailor takes measurements and says, come back in a week. And he comes back in a week and he starts putting on the suit. And he says, well, this sleeve is a little bit too long. Or this, and they say, oh, no, no, you just need to hold your hand like this and it will be fine. And he holds his hand like this and the sleeve looks nice. Well, this sleeve also is a bit too short. It goes a bit this way. So he says, oh, this hand you have to hold like that. And it goes on like that. And finally he stands like a totally crippled creature, but the suit looks perfect on him. But that's what we're doing with our belief systems. We believe all those things about ourselves and crippling ourselves with them. Much worse than the suit example. Much worse. So the practice, any spiritual practice you do, is really about breaking down those superstitions in any way you can, whatever way you can. not limiting ourselves to a normal way of being, to an ordinary way of being, not limiting things to being things in their ordinary sense, because they're not. We live in little boxes and we put the boxes around everything around us. So this is the application of this verse in your life. Figure out your own limitations. Figure out your own belief systems and where they put you. And realize where they're coming from. See the fear behind them so you can let go of them. And that's not an easy thing. And everybody has to do that work on their spiritual path to this enlightened state of being, is to figure out those systems and to let go of them, break them down. We're going back to the first verse. So Master Sara talks about emptiness and compassion, and he talks about the need for both. Then the same Master Avaduti, the commentator for Master Sara, says to link them, you have to understand pain. You really have to understand what's suffering, where it's coming from, and how to stop it. And he says we shouldn't be stuck in those two ways of holding that we've mentioned before. Holding to wrong views, that things are the way they appear to me, and they function the way they appear in the normal reality. Letting go of that superstition, of that belief system. And also letting go of holding to wisdom, to the understanding of those. Also letting go of that, not as a self-existent wisdom. If our goal is to become enlightened, and if becoming enlightened means that we are in total bliss all the time, then what would be the path that we would use to reach there? We are practicing to become this all blissful being, then I have to incorporate bliss into my path. I'm not there yet, I'm not a fully enlightened being, I'm not 24/7 in total, extreme, amazing ecstasy. So how will I reach that state? So I have to practice bliss even now. It's essential on the path. You can't be a suffering, miserable, a recluse, and all of a sudden bliss will happen. You have to practice bliss for this to happen. Or else your path will never produce a Buddha if it doesn't have bliss as a component in it. But that's the direction. So we're talking about joyful effort on our path, right? Master Shantideva talks about this perfection of a bodhisattva, to do things joyfully. People who act with compassion often are happier. People who do Tonglen meditations, for example, that have strong compassion component, then because of that they're planting seeds in their mind that force on them happiness. Happiness has to be part of the path. If it's not happening, you're not doing the right thing. It has to be happening. It happens gradually, but it has to come from being content, to being happy, to being totally happy, to being blissful. You know, it has to go along this progression somehow, or else you're not doing the right thing. You know, when the Buddha came to teach Tantra, he came in a different form. He came in the form of Vajradhara. That's how he's called when he teaches Tantra. It says in the Tantras that Vajradhara is made of the combined bliss of all men and angels. And that's what a Buddha is. It's combined bliss. And that's what we will become in the end. We will be made of that love and bliss. That's what we will become in the end. He says, once you realize it, it is everything there is. If it were any different, how could it ever be perceived? This is what we read about, this is what we memorize, this is what we contemplate, this is what we describe as the heart of every sacred text. It is not that kind of view which can be put to words. for it is only granted by relying on your Lama's words. So, all this amazing wisdom, which is combined with method, which is this total bliss, our deepest dream, which cannot really be put into words, that ultimate wisdom cannot be described in words, because it's beyond words. He says, it is only granted by relying on your Lama's words. So we need to reach that wisdom, we need to reach that wisdom of emptiness, and we need help for that. It's a big job. Without the Lama's grace, there's no way we can get there. Impossible. Now, the Lama can't do it for us if we don't give them the power to help us. It's our job to empower our Lamas, to give them the power so they can help us reach those goals. And it's the only way. From their own side, they're just like the pen, they're empty. They're not holy Lamas from their own side. They're not normal people from their own side. They're empty. If we create the causes, if we invest them with the power through our dedication, through our service, through our faith in them, then they will lead us out of suffering. Then they will lead us to this ultimate answer. So that's maybe the last thing. May all beings all over the world, wherever they may be, be always happiest in me, be always totally free. In all the things I do, all the words I say, all the thoughts that I have, may be the causes which will point their faith.